Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 403, titled Let's Make a Deal, subtitled None Dare Call It Treason. In the concluding section of the first side of this broadcast, I was describing the very complex events of September 11th as being analogous to the French capitulation in World War II, in which there was obviously an attack from a hostile foreign power, Germany, but because of the structural economic relationships and ideological sympathies between the French industrialists and financiers, in particular French steelmakers and their German counterparts, and because of the fear on the part of elements of the French elite of the possible implications of democracy for their position of primacy, the French military resistance in World War II was actively subverted from within. It was a hostile foreign attack by a hostile foreign power combined with a deliberate program of subversion by an influential fifth column in order to establish fascism in France. In connection with September 11th, it was not just a Pearl Harbor or just a Reichstag fire, but a very similar event, in my opinion. Sort of Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag fire, as I talked about it in 344, 345, and 346. We're going to take a look at a very ominous element of this event. Again, sort of Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag fire, like those old B-grade horror movies, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, or Frankenstein meets Dracula. There were a whole bunch of these things in the 1940s and 1950s. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this for us from the Observer of London of Sunday, February 23rd of 2003. This is an article by Ed Vulliamy, V-U-L-L-I-A-M-Y, in New York. It's headlined, Two Men Driving Bush into War. And it talks about Karl Rove and Paul Wolfowitz. And talking about Paul Wolfowitz, we read the following, skipping down. In 1992, just before Bush's father was defeated by Bill Clinton, Wolfowitz wrote a blueprint to, quote, set the nation's direction for the next century, unquote, which is now the foreign policy of George W. Bush. Entitled Defense Planning Guidance, unquote, it put an onus on the Pentagon to, quote, establish and protect a new order, unquote, under unchallenged American authority. The U.S., it said, must be sure of, quote, deterring potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role, unquote, including Germany and Japan. It contemplated the use of nuclear, biological, and chemical weaponry preemptively, quote, even in conflicts that do not directly engage U.S. interests, unquote. Wolfowitz's group formalized itself into a group called Project for the New American Century, which included Cheney, and another old friend, former Pentagon Undersecretary for Policy under Reagan, Richard Perle. In a document 2 years ago, the project pondered that what was needed to assure U.S. global power was, quote, some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, unquote. That sentence again. In a document 2 years ago, this, by the way, was roughly September of 2000, the project pondered that what was needed to assure U.S. global power was, quote, and this is quoting from the document, some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, unquote. The document had noted that, quote, while the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides immediate justification, unquote, for intervention, again quoting, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein, unquote. And that is very interesting indeed. Wolfowitz was part of this project for a new American century, and it ruminated about the need for a catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. I noted a number of indications, aside from all of the intelligence failures that came out in the spring of 2002, the FBI official in charge of the bin Laden investigation had his investigation actively frustrated in Yemen, as discussed in For the Record Program 310. That program recorded on June 24th of 2001 ruminated about the appointment, among other things, of Robert Mueller as head of the FBI as putting him in position to cover up the Bush/Bin Laden family links through the James R. Bath connection, the Texas business representative for Salem bin Laden and for the bin Mahfouz family, and ruminated that, in fact, Mueller's position in part, and again, it was Mueller who was in charge of the BCCI investigation that was badly attenuated. I speculated about his appointment as perhaps portending an interdiction of any adequate investigation of the Bush-Bin Laden business connections. This was on June 24th of 2001. It aired on WFMU, which is in Jersey City, New Jersey, right across the river from Ground Zero, between 6 and 7 p.m. on Monday, September 10th. You can listen to that at the WFMU streaming website, wfmu.org/Dave Emery. For the record, 310 aired basically at Ground Zero about 15 or 16 hours before John O'Neill died. In the summer of 2000, John O'Neill had a briefcase stolen from him in Tampa, Florida, which detailed every counterintelligence and counterterror operation in the greater New York area. And I talked about those two facts in For the Record 325 and in For the Record 326, among other shows. One of the things that I believe is being done is to scapegoat Israel for what is basically a much larger policy. Indeed, we're hearing a fair amount of discussion that, well, the only reason we're going into Iraq is because this suits Israel's needs. In fact, in that context, leaving aside the whole issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which I've spoken about in the past, and I believe that the subversion of the peace talks at Camp David were accomplished by the Republicans, who had strong links to the PLO through Saudi Arabia, which finances the PLO, also through Baker's Dozen, the PLO negotiating team. Many of the so-called moderate Palestinians had in fact been brought to the United States and were coached by the Central Intelligence Agency in the latest PR techniques. They were brought over by James Baker, the first George Bush's Secretary of State, and they were dubbed by the agency Baker's Dozen. The day, September 25th of 2000. Take a look at the front page of the New York Times. The lead story is Arafat walking out of the Camp David peace accords. The second story was about oil man George Bush appointing oil man Dick Cheney as his vice president. And I suspect that one of the motives for that was to for the subversion, which I believe took place at the Camp David peace accords. Had Clinton brokered a successful negotiation between the PLO and the Israelis, that would have given Al Gore the victory. It also would not have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would not be a scapegoat for what is taking place now. An interesting perspective, and bear in mind the Project for a New American Century, and bear in mind the efforts in that regard by, among others, Paul Wolfowitz, and the very ominous call for a catalyzing, the rumination about the catalyzing effect of a new Pearl Harbor. The New York Times of March 8th of 2003 had an op-ed column by Bill Keller. It's titled, Is It Good for the Jews? This reads in part as follows. 2 weeks ago, a group of senior intelligence officials in the Defense Department sat for an hour listening to a briefing by a writer who claims, I am not making this up, that messages encoded in the Hebrew text of the Old Testament provide clues to the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. One of the officials told me that they had agreed to meet the writer Michael Drosnin, author of a Nostradamus-style bestseller, without understanding that he was promoting biblical prophecy. And talking about conspiracy theory and September 11th, skipping down, Exhibit A for this is talking about the notion that that September 11th was an Israeli conspiracy and that so was Iraq. The conspiracy theory appears in several variations, ranging from malignant to merely cynical, but it goes something like this. A cadre of pro-Zionist zealots within the Bush administration and among its media chorus, the Amen Corner, as the isolationist Pat Buchanan crudely called them last time we threatened Iraq, has long schemed to make the Middle East safer for Israel by uprooting the hostile regime of Saddam Hussein. They have finally succeeded, the theory goes, in pushing their agenda up to the desk of a gullible president. Exhibit A for this plot is a document entitled A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, unquote, prepared in 1996 by a group of American defense thinkers for the hardline Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel. This study proposed an aggressive redirection of Israeli strategy, including a plan removing Saddam Hussein from power, unquote. Three of the authors of the prescription, Richard Pearl, Douglas Feith, and David Wormser, are now prominent embeds, unquote, in the Bush administration. Note the following two paragraphs. The Clean Break Group, interestingly, did not call for an American conquest of Saddam, skipping down. They promised that Israel, they proposed that Israel handle it together with Jordan and Turkey. Jordan's Hashemite dynasty would share the management of Iraq with the Shiites, presumably leaving the fate of the poor Kurds in Turkish hands. As for America, the document proposed that Israel adopt a new policy of self-reliance, immediately declining economic aid and eventually military assistance. This was all a bit much, even for the ultranationalist Mr. Netanyahu. A less conspiracy-minded observer might point out that the long-standing Bushite animosity toward Iraq is complex and hardly secret, and the fact that our interests coincide with Israel's does not mean that a Zionist fifth column has hijacked the president's brain. But that would not satisfy the yearning for a simple story. Well, I strongly suspect that a lot of the kicking around of the Zionists are behind September 11th and Iraq, etc., leaving aside the fact, obviously, the far-right and explicitly fascist elements will be engaging in such anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Note all of the circulation that things like that have been getting in the so-called progressive sector as well. The influence of the intelligence community in the so-called progressive sector, as always, note the use of the term so-called, could not be exaggerated. And I suspect that much of that has to do with shifting blame from not only the Bush administration, but also from the fact of the oil industry to the Israelis, basically the Jews, the Jewish conspiracy line. I would note in that regard, are the president and vice president of the United States A, rabbis, or B, petroleum industry executives? And also, the last time you filled up your gas tank, did you fill it up with A, matzo ball soup, or B, gasoline? One of the things that I think is going on in connection with September 11th is and also the situation in Iraq, I think the United States is walking into a geopolitical trap, a trap that was laid possibly even during the closing stages of World War II or in its immediate aftermath. And I believe that just as von Clausewitz observed that war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means, so too, diplomacy is the continuation of war by other means. And we've spoken about this in a number of recent broadcasts, including, by the way, for the record, 366 and 372. I would note in this context that what I believe is going on in September 11th is a geopolitical struggle for control of the Earth Island. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood as impugning the sincere feelings on behalf of peace on the part of many of the people who have been demonstrating. Yet at the same time, I think that the motives of the French and German governments, and bear in mind that corporate France has been controlled by corporate Germany even before World War II, and that control was cemented in World War II due to the structural economic relationships that I alluded to earlier, I believe that the French and German motives for this particular situation are altogether cynical. I would note also the weakening of the dollar as a reserve currency in connection with the euro. I would also note that if the United States winds up bankrupting itself, which is a very real possibility, that in turn will accomplish the goals of the underground Reich. And I believe not only manipulating world opinion in general, and in particular Arab and Muslim opinion in an anti-U.S. direction, is one of the goals of the underground Reich. I believe that the bankrupting of the United States and the supplanting of the dollar with the euro as the reserve currency of choice, which would break the United States, is the real goal of the underground Reich. And I suspect that we are looking at an ambush that was laid. And I'm going to be detailing some aspects of what I believe was a conspiracy theory, what I believe is going on. And this, by the way, is a conspiracy theory. One of the interesting things that has taken place in connection with the, at this point, relatively well-publicized pipeline deal that Unocal, has been negotiating with, was negotiating with the Taliban about, is that that pipeline deal across Afghanistan was originally negotiated by the Argentine petroleum company Bridas, that was founded in Peron's Argentina in the immediate aftermath of World War II. Translate, Borman Organization. As we've looked at in For the Record 305, and this is discussed, actually you can read the text in the description for the Record 305, Martin Borman held a joint bank account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón and was banking under his own name since 1941 with a number of different banks in the U.S. and in Argentina. We're going to take a look now at the book that was alluded to in the subject of the Khalid bin Mahfouz lawsuit. This is the book Forbidden Truth, subtitled U.S. Taliban Secret Oil Diplomacy and the Failed Hunt for Bin Laden, co-authored by Jean-Charles Brizard and Guillaume Dasquier, who have been sued by Khalid bin Mahfouz. The book was published in softcover by the Nation Books, Thunder's Mouth Press and Nation Books. It was copyright 2002 by the authors. And there's discussion in this book of the negotiation with the Taliban and with oil companies to build a pipeline across Afghanistan. And it appears, as we discussed in For the Record 362, that this was known by Mohammed Atef, who was the operations chief for Al-Qaeda, and that this may very well have been used to keep U.S. intelligence quiet. Or certainly this may have been taken advantage of by the September 11th conspirators, knowing that as long as the negotiations were taking place, that basically there was not going to be a serious crackdown on Al-Qaeda. Note what I discussed in For the Record 394, The Battle of Men with Hill, and consider the following. Consider basically the underground Reich ambushing the U.S., and consider that people like Wolfowitz and others are sort of looking at a three-dimensional situation in one or two dimensions. And if, in fact, the United States can be lured into a draining war of attrition with the Muslim world, and with George Bush slashing revenues dramatically as he is increasing expenditures, I'll toss the gauntlet down to anybody to cite a world leader who successfully slashed revenues while waging war. If, in fact, the upcoming war in Iraq is successful. It's to be hoped, basically, that it's successful. On the other hand, if it is, this is going to be used in all probability by the Bush administration, if there's a bump up in the polls, to implement his tax cuts, which will destroy the United States as thoroughly as any terrorist group could possibly hope to do. It will bankrupt the United States. And among other things, this will be a national security consideration. The military won't be able to finance its weapon systems, and the United States might very well end up like the former Soviet Union. But consider the following, and this in connection with an ambush, a trap that I believe the U.S. is basically walking into. And again, Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag fire, but consider the institution that was initially proposing the Afghan pipeline deal. Chapter 3 of Forbidden Truth is called A Pipeline for the Taliban. One man would meet these expectations and was instrumental in soliciting outside help to bring the Taliban to power. Naturally, it was an oil man. But Carlos Bulgaroni, B-U-L-G-H-E-R-O-N-I, is not Saudi Arabian or Pakistani or American. He is Argentinian. He is the president of Bridas, the fourth largest energy group in Latin America, based in Buenos Aires and founded after World War II. In the 1970s, Bridas became a world player. With India and Pakistan on the brink of war in 1991 and 1992, Bridas executives recognized the necessity of forging partnerships with new executives in the former Soviet republics, especially in Turkmenistan. From their offices in Islamabad, they envisioned a stable Afghanistan run by leaders who were willing to cooperate with them so they could build oil and gas pipelines connecting Turkmenistan to Pakistan. Bulgaroni struck his first deal with the government of Turkmenistan in January of 1992 to exploit a field in Daulatabad. On March 15, 1995, he brought together Pakistani and Turkmen officials who signed an agreement in principle for the construction of a pipeline crossing Afghanistan. At that point, Bulgaroni invited other oil companies to join his business venture, including Unocal, one of the largest oil corporations in the United States. By the way, the elder George Bush has a lot of stock in Unocal. The Union Oil Company of California was founded in Santa Paula in 1890 and changed its name to Unocal Corporation in 1983. One of the success stories of the energy industry, it became, under the direction of its president, Roger Beach, one of the, quote, world's largest independent oil and gas producers, unquote, in the 1990s. A savvy businessman, Beach immediately recognized the potential of Carlos Bulgaroni's offer, so much so that he decided he could do without Bridas's services and invest in the region without their help. To improve his bargaining position and get financial backing, he enlisted the help of another group, the Saudi company Delta Oil. So again, it was an Argentine oil company, Bridas, that first negotiated with the Taliban for the pipeline deal, later bringing in Unocal. Bridas founded in the immediate aftermath of World War II, inevitably involving the Borman Organization. And the negotiations between the Taliban and representatives of the petroleum companies in the U.S. were taking place in Germany. The Vendrell here is Francais, F-R-A-N-C-E-S-C, Vendrell. And again, noting that these negotiations took place in Germany and noting that the initial pipeline deal was being initiated by an Argentinian oil company founded in the immediate aftermath of World War II, again, my complex hypothesis of the virtual state of the underground Reich, basically instituting a let's you and him fight scenario in which we are being lured into a trap. And basically in which elements in the Middle East are being used as proxy warriors, I think, warrants scrutiny under the circumstances. Turning again to forbidden truth. According to Niaz Naik, at least three rounds of meetings took place in Germany under Vendrell's authority in November of 2000 and then March and July of 2001. The meetings focused on getting the Taliban to sign an armistice with the Northern Alliance, creating a government of national unity, and obtaining the extradition of Osama bin Laden. Quote, "We would try to convey to them that if they did certain things, then gradually they could win the jackpot, get something in return from the international community," unquote. The objective was to convince the Taliban that once a broad-based government of national unity was installed and the pipeline project was in the works, there would be billions of dollars in commission, of which the Taliban, with their own resources, would get a cut. By the way, Enron appears to have been brokering this deal. Saudi bin Laden Group was going to get the pipeline construction contract, and it appears that Al-Qaeda was aware of this. Everyone involved wanted the radical regime to peacefully cede some of its power and to subscribe to U.S. priorities, but the deal fell short. In Berlin on July 17th, a third secret meeting was supposed to occur. And again, these negotiations were taking place in Berlin. Skipping down, in the course of these last talks in Berlin, and in the absence of Taliban representatives, according to the Pakistani representative, Naiz Naik, the small American delegation mentioned using a, quote, military option against the Taliban if they did not agree to change their position, especially concerning Osama bin Laden. Again, I think it would be a serious error in judgment to view Islamo-fascists or Islamic fundamentalists, and Al-Qaeda in particular, as merely a creation of the United States. That is, I think, in my opinion, a serious error in judgment, but yet I think the available situation does indeed suggest a Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag scenario, and I believe that the underground Reich is luring the United States into a trap. Now, in consideration of that, note again the Perón regime in Argentina, and note that the current Syrian-born president of Argentina has been covering up the Argentine Nazi links and that he himself is a Peronist. New York Times, March 9, 2003, article by Larry Roter, Dateline Buenos Aires, Argentina, a haven for Nazis, balks at opening its files. Now, why do you suppose they would be balking after all this time? It reads in part, "Under fire because of a new book that documents for the first time how Juan Perón clandestinely maneuvered to bring Nazi and other war criminals to Argentina after World War II, the Peronist government here is resisting calls to release long secret official records about the collaboration. According to the Simon Wiesenthal Center here, both the Foreign Relations Ministry and the Interior Ministries have failed to respond to letters sent to them shortly after the book was published here late last year asking that the records be made public. In addition, seven members of Congress have now called for an investigation into how crucial immigration records were apparently destroyed 6 years ago in defiance of existing laws. The book that ignited the controversy, published in the United States as The Real Odessa, Smuggling the Nazis to Perón's Argentina, has become a bestseller here. Its author, Uki Gonyi, is an Argentine journalist who had to do much of his research in European archives after encountering closed doors here. And skipping down, according to records Mr. Gonyi has uncovered here and abroad, Perón's government, which was in power from 1946 to 1955, shepherded nearly 300 war criminals into the country. Besides such notorious figures as Adolf Eichmann, Josef Mengele, and Klaus Barbie, dozens of French, Belgian, Italian, Croatian, and Slovak fascists, many of them Nazi collaborators sought in their home nations, were also admitted, some under aliases, others under their real names. Skipping down. In 1992, the president at the time, Carlos Saul Menem, also a Peronist, ordered that all documents relating to the Argentine government's dealings with the Nazis be made public. But that decree, like the findings of a foreign ministry commission set up in 1997 to examine similar links, appears to have produced little of use to historians or victims of the war criminals who settled here. And one of the interesting things there is there are links between the AMIA bombing and the Oklahoma City bombing and to the Middle East. The AMIA Jewish Cultural Center in Argentina was a repository for records on war criminals. San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 10th of 2003, article by Larry Roter, also of the New York Times, Iranians accused in bombing of Argentine Jewish Center. An Argentine judge has ordered arrest warrants for four Iranian government officials who says he helped organize and carry out the 1994 bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires that left 85 people dead. We talked about this in For the Record 373, For the Record 109, For the Record number 330 as well. Now note that among the war criminals described in that particular article about the Menem government's cover-up of these records was Klaus Barbie. His attorney was Jacques Vergès, a protege of François Genoux. And one of Jacques Vergès's law partners is Isabelle Coutant-Père, who is currently the French attorney for Zaharias Moussaoui, the accused 20th hijack. And I think much of the French-U.S. dispute in this regard can be understood in that regard. François Genoux is one of the most important post-war, one of the most important Third Reich spies in the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-war underground Reich phases. François Genoux's friend and attorney, Baudin Dunant, is co-chairman of the board of SICO, the parent company of Saudi Bin Laden Group, reviewing from For the Record program number 354, among other programs, again from the book In the Name of Osama Bin Laden by Roland Jacquard. Speaking of SICO, it is headed by Islam bin Laden, and the board of directors is made up almost exclusively of members of the family clan, except for the co-chairman of the board, a Swiss citizen, Baudin Dunant. This well-known lawyer from French-speaking Switzerland, who was on the boards of several dozen companies, came to public notice in 1983 when he agreed to represent the Swiss banker François Genoux, a controversial figure who had been a disciple of Hitler and sole heir of Goebbels' copyrights before becoming one of the financiers of the FLN during the Algerian War. And one of the many institutions with which Genoux was associated, and his name crops up in connection with September 11th in a variety of contexts, is the Baader-Meinhof gang, and concluding from In the Name of Osama bin Laden, historically, terrorist groups have never gone very far in the area of biological warfare. In the 1980s, the German far-left Baader-Meinhof terrorist gang threatened to spread anthrax bacteria through the mail in West Germany, but the threat was never carried out. Was that a paradigm for the anthrax attacks in this country? Food for thought, grounds for further research. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 403. Let's Make a Deal, subtitled None Dare Call It Treason, being recorded on March 17th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.